Do you think life is simpler after you retire? For some, it's actually more complicated when facing issues about health, estate plans, probate, long-term care, and more. That's why attorney CPA Joe Cordell hosts Elder Talk with Joe Cordell, providing smart solutions for seniors and an open forum for older adults with important questions about their future. Here's attorney CPA Joe Cordell.
Welcome to another episode of Elder Talk. Today we're going to talk about common mistakes that people make when they do their estate planning. Now, estate planning includes more than just wills. We talk a lot about trusts on here, but really we're talking about the goal of transferring the stuff that you've sweated, that you've worked, that you've expended presumably a lot of effort acquiring over the years, that you'd be able to leave that to the people you care most about. And too often those plans go awry. So we're going to talk about common errors that people make when they're thinking about their planning for those to receive their goods after they're gone.
And some of these are going to be a little bit simplistic. You know, sometimes you think, oh, I would never do that. Well, they're there for a reason, because sometimes we do just those things we don't mean to do.
And we're trying to keep it simple. We try not to get too technical on this show. So, Susan, do you want to start us off?
All right. So what we have now, one of the things that people do all the time, and you don't think they're going to do it, is they lose their will. Now, how in the world do you lose your will? You think, oh, well, I'm not going to do that. I mean, sure, I've lost my glasses and I've lost something else, but I'm not going to lose my will. Where's the best place to keep a will? The box under your bed?
Well, actually, if you think about it, I think that many of us would be surprised that more wills aren't lost.
Mm-hmm.
Think about how many pieces of paper we lose.
Mm-hmm.
Now, on the one hand, you would argue, well, as you just did, this is an important thing. How do you manage to lose this important document? Well, you lose a lot of important documents, particularly the things that you're supposed to keep track of maybe for decades.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if many people don't update their wills. They should. We all know that, but many don't. So you have this piece of paper, this sheaf of papers that have been shuffled around from here to there. Maybe there have been a couple of moves.
That's what I was just going to say. I mean, let's say I did the right thing. I put it into my lockbox, my fireproof safe. But then we moved, and maybe I took it out, or I moved those documents, and I'm not sure where that ended up because I had a bunch of friends helping, or the movers lost it. Now what?
Well, and let me set the stage for how the court views this situation. So when someone can testify, or there's otherwise evidence that clearly there was a will, but they don't know where it is, then there's a presumption in the law that's been around for probably a century plus, that the person destroyed it. If you know they had it, if there's unequivocal evidence that they had this document at one time and now it can't be found, unless there's some other explanation, persuasive evidence for which can be offered to the court, then the court's going to adopt the presumption that the document was destroyed. Now, what are the consequences of that? It means that you have died intestate.
There's that word again. We've talked about it
before. That word, intestate. It means that the rules created by the legislature will determine who gets what. And there's a good chance that that is not going to mirror what your intentions are. A very good chance,
mm-hmm.
in fact. However, people often, in an effort to save their wills, will sometimes put them in the places where they're most difficult to find. Now, I've heard arguments both ways on a safe deposit box. I think safe deposit boxes are a good idea. Banks monitor deaths, public records, as part of their responsibility. They have authority to open a safe deposit box after they know that someone has passed. So the probability that it will make its way to the court eventually is pretty strong, in my opinion, if you have a safe deposit box. I've read, and perhaps these are laws in other states, where some attorneys who I know are good at what they do, they're estate planning lawyers, and some don't like that idea. Some say leave it with your lawyer.
Mm-hmm. I've heard that.
Well, that's not a bad idea to have the original with the lawyer. However, keep in mind that law firms go out of business. Lawyers retire. They die.
They move too.
Unfortunately, they die, depending on your perspective. So that may not be a safe decision. However, if you have one of these more, I hate to say this, the institutional sort of law firms then you might argue, well, they've been around 150 years. I think they'll be around another 50. That may be a fair assumption. And in fairness to smaller firms, such as Cordell Planning Partners, many of us, plan for that. And we know that we will have clients someday who will pass, and we expect the firm to be in business through existing attorneys now at the firm who will succeed as others of us retire. So we don't have an intention at some point to close the office. And even law firms, let me say this on behalf of lawyers who do have very small practices and retire, is that they have a responsibility to take care of those files, to hand those off to someone with the client's approval that can assure some continuity there. At a minimum, they return all the records to the client, they inform them of the change that's taken place, and give the client the opportunity to make new arrangements. So it's not a bad idea to have a will with a lawyer. And then some will put it in the hands of the person that they intend to be their executor.
Your children.
Yeah.
I mean, just recently I was handed a document and they said, here, keep track of this. I'm thinking, you should keep track of it, but now I'm keeping track of it.
And it also puts that person in a vulnerable position. I mean, often things are not perfectly harmonious among children. Is it possible that there could be arguments, accusations of undue influence, big, big item in dissatisfaction regarding wills? Mm-hmm. And it's a basis for much contention in probate courts across America. So I think maybe leaving it with the executor may not be a bad idea, depending on the context of your family and the age of your executor and a variety of circumstances, the personality, how responsible is this person, conscientious, et cetera. So there are several options, and there's no single best rule for everybody. I do like safe deposit boxes, and I like firms that are established that you can have confidence that that there will be transmission of your document. And again, that doesn't require a big firm. It requires a firm that has made arrangements so that you can be reasonably confident.
With all of the technology today, is it a good idea to scan it and keep an electronic copy somewhere as well? Or will that be, does it have to be notarized or anything like that? Anything that would make that invalid?
No. Some people will make a copy of a will, but there is a thing called the best evidence rule. So to the extent that there's an original, it has to be found and located. But the real point, interestingly enough, is that someone be able to testify that a will was properly executed. These formalities that people hear about where you have two witnesses and the person will sometimes audibly say, this is the will I'm signing, and they have, in the presence of each other, they have to sign as witnesses that they saw this person sign this document and they understood it to be their will. So these formalities are the real issue, and there are cases where actually the will itself couldn't be found, but there was sufficient evidence that it was executed and it was executed properly, and beyond the control of the person who created it or without their intention, it disappears. So it's not a bad idea to have a copy, but you want to be careful how many copies are floating around.
Okay.
That can be a problem.
Okay. All right. So now that we've decided we have made our will, we have put it in a safe place, now we're going to look at what goes inside of it. And one of the most common mistakes that people make, and then they don't even think about it, is they forget or they don't provide properly for one of the most important members of their family, and that's their pet. Now, that may sound a little bit simple, but that happens more often than we think about.
And I think that people would be more surprised to hear that if we were having this conversation 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I think today pets are so common and their role has been enhanced in the families. So I don't think many people are surprised to hear us discuss the fact that many people want to provide for their pets. It's hard to coordinate your lifespan with your pets, particularly if you've acquired a pet, within, say, 10 years of your possible death or less. People do that.
And you can actually establish a trust for the care of your pet. I mean, there was a famous case where I believe it was Leona Helmsley or something like that. She left a large amount of money to her particular pet. And so a lot that may be a little bit overboard, but you do want to make sure that your pet is cared for. Maybe you have a family member. I mean, I'm probably not the person you're going to leave your pet to, but I have family members who would love to take care of your pet. So you really do want to think about those things.
It is, and it can be an imposition if you don't make specific provision for it, where somebody that they may like pets, but it's a big responsibility to ask your children or someone else to raise your pet or mm-hmm. to take care of your pet. Not a huge responsibility, but more than some would be happy with, I'll put it that way.
Oh, sure.
And some would be quite unhappy, mm-hmm. people who don't care for pets. But I think that now people need to be aware that there is a trust mechanism that wasn't available prior to, 2005? When Missouri adopted the Uniform Trust Code, the Uniform Trust Code now has a provision to deal officially with the care of animals. Used to, this was called an honorary trust. And as the name implies, it's based on the honor of the person who receives the pet and the request to take care of it, and even the money to take care of it. It was still honorary. It wasn't really enforceable by the courts. They would allow the wish to take place, but there was no mechanism for enforcement. So beginning in 2005, this was formally adopted so that now you can create a trust that is enforceable for the care of your animal.
Hmm.
And you name somebody who essentially is a trustee, and they have that responsibility of assuring that that care takes place. It doesn't mean that that particular person themselves has to be responsible for that, although they often are.
Okay.
But my point is it could be a third party. So now this is actually enforceable. They have the ability, and an interested third party would have the ability, to bring an action for the enforcement of this in the event that it wasn't happening the way it should.
Hmm.
So you have to leave a reasonable amount. There is a lifespan. The span on these is the remaining lifespan of an animal that was in existence at the time of your death.
Okay.
So used to, it was, in some states, it was like 20 years, just an arbitrary amount. But for animals, it can be an unlimited amount. It just can't be for an animal that was born after your death.
Okay.
So it's kind of a natural cap, but it does mean it could span, depending on the type of animal, it could go, 30, 40 years?
It could.
Yeah.
It could. I mean, a lot of dogs are 14 or 15, and that's, if you've got a fairly young puppy, that would be a 15-year commitment.
I'm curious, just wondering how it would be dealt with if you had one of these massive turtles. What are they called? These massive turtles that live for 100 years?
I don't know.
Years.
Some of them do live a long time. Yeah. Some of those reptiles.
I've heard of people having these as pets, and I was in a conversation with someone in the last 5 years who was telling me that, their family has one, and it's been around about 40 years.
Oh, my word.
And they expect it to be around much longer. So I assume then that in that case you could create a trust that would endure for that animal's lifespan.
Interesting.
I guess a turtle's an animal, right?
Sure.
Okay.
You don't take it for walks very much.
Yeah, yeah. Whenever you're thinking about taking care of pets, and this isn't just for older people. Now, of course, it applies primarily to someone who's 65, 70, 75 plus who acquire pets. My mother, for example, has gotten a couple of pets since mm-hmm. that point and is still living. For those people, I think it behooves them mm-hmm. to make provision for that pet. And you can leave money for the care. Now, it has to be a reasonable amount. If the court concludes that the amount's excessive, they can take that excess money and redistribute it to your heirs. In other words, they don't have to the extent that you're engaging in something that the court would regard as frivolous,
mm-hmm.
like $1 million for your dog that has about 5 years to go that's to be used for the dog's care, the court will not enforce something that's frivolous.
Okay.
So that's the rules on pets.
All right. So now that we have some of our family taken care of with our pets, let's look at some of the next big mistakes. One of the next big mistakes involves property. There's a couple of things with property that we need to make sure that we do. We need to make sure that we have all of our personal property maybe put into a revocable living trust, or we need to list some of these things, including things that we don't even think about, like any of your creative assets, like artwork or music or anything that you would create that you want protected.
Yeah, people often think about the stuff for which there's a title, like a deed. Many people, when they create a trust, they understand, I need to put my real estate in there. So often they'll be pretty diligent about those things. They'll have their lawyer. In fact, typically the lawyer that creates the trust will go ahead and create that deed so that it'll be transferred in. Same thing with a certificate of title for real estate, boat, or for cars, boats, etc. But what people often don't do is they often do not transfer their personal property. And it's so easy to do what's called a certificate of gift. It could be a deed of gift. All it is a piece of paper by which you say, I hereby transfer all of my personal property, my personalty is the legal term, transfer all my personalty that I own into this trust. By that simple document, you have effectively placed in the trust all those forms of personal property, which includes a lot of stuff, tangible, intangible stuff. You get an example like a patent or trademark or art or whatnot. Tangible, intangible, various documents that might be, they might be something that you own only a partial interest in, but you can still transfer the portion that you do own an interest in.
So, say a company or something like that, you mean?
Yeah, it could be companies, certificates of stock, for example, those things. Now, keep in mind, though, that something that does have a certificate of title, you really want to change the certificate itself. You don't want to simply rely on the fact that, oh, that's personal property, I can put it in that way. It's not going to be reliable. I think that to the extent you want the trust to have control, I would go ahead and change the name on those certificates, just as you would, for example, with a motor vehicle. But this is something that it's a simple thing to do, incredibly simple to have your personal stuff inside. And some people, incidentally, a lot of values in those personal items. They may have collections of things. And I would argue that if it is, though, a piece of personal property that has a whole lot of value, you may want to deal with it specifically by name in the trust.
That's what I was wondering. So you don't have to make a big, long list and try to remember absolutely everything. But if there is a family heirloom, for example, or like you said, maybe a collection of things that you want to be specifically provided
included
for, or so that you do want to make sure that you list somewhere in that trust.
You probably want to list it in part because you want to identify who you want to get that. That can be the subject of a lot of dispute. But technically, to the extent that you create this deed of gift, so to speak, this piece of paper in which you transfer all your personal property, technically, you've transferred even a $10 million coin collection. Without mentioning it, technically you've transferred all that personal property into your trust.
So is this just a standard thing that most attorneys would do, or do you need to ask for this?
Most attorneys would think of this, but attorneys can sometimes lose sight of these smaller things, and often it is smaller things in the personality, because they're focusing on the things that have required most of their attention or their expertise. Making arrangements with the real estate, 401ks, other things such as that. So, no, it is possible it would be overlooked in the process.
Okay, well, so now we're going to move on to real estate. We're going to look at some of the things that might, some of the mistakes that might happen when you're involved with real estate. So what about when real estate passes, what if there's loans and there's mortgages that are there? Do we incur all of that? What do we need to do to make sure that that's taken care of to the best of our ability?
Well, keep in mind that if you have debt on your real estate and you transfer the real estate into a trust, that's probably going to trigger a due on sale provision. The due on sale provision is a routine term that's in loans that are secured by a mortgage that says that if you transfer the property, or which we would include into a trust, then you have triggered an acceleration provision. The acceleration provision means that suddenly everything is due. Yeah, you suddenly have to pay off the entire amount. So many people are not aware of that when they make those transfers. Now, I'll tell you that those are sometimes not reported to the lender for whatever reason. So sometimes it flies under the radar of lenders who would otherwise have enforced this. I can tell you that it's not unusual for people to naively to just put their real estate into their trust, their house, and maybe they'll have a mortgage on the house and they won't pay any attention to it and nothing is ever said. So it goes on that way, and ultimately the property is paid off after their death. But technically, clients should be aware that there is a risk that whenever you transfer property into a trust that you're going to trigger that due on sale clause, and that can create a crisis for some.
Oh, sure.
And let me tell you, though, also that we've had some success contacting lenders in advance and using a frontal approach and getting their permission to transfer. If you think about it, a reasonable lender, why would they be uncomfortable with that? They shouldn't be, because their rights have not been compromised at all. We assure that the trust would still give them the same power and authority they would have otherwise. To the extent that the person to whom they lent the money doesn't pay them, then they can foreclose, mm-hmm. just as they otherwise could. So all the remedies are still available to them that would otherwise be. So there's really a pretty strong argument for giving permission. But some very institutional mega lenders, they simply aren't prepared to take the time to evaluate particular cases and particular trusts. So they just have this sweeping position that, look, we're going to stand by the terms of our trust. And it's a change of title because it's changed from the title of you and your wife individually, for example, to you and your wife as trustees for such and such trust.
So if they do that, if they do call the note due, can you take it back out of the trust? Is there anything that you can do so that you don't have to have that all due at one time?
As a practical matter, you could, but could they say no? I mean, have you technically breached the term? Yeah, you've technically breached it. Hmm. I'd have to read the provisions of any particular case, but I would say the way that they're typically worded, yeah, there's no correcting it once you've done it. And I'm being very technical here. I can tell you that as a practical matter, lenders are not wanting to put themselves in a position where they have a piece of real estate on their hands right now. And so I think that lenders tend to be reasonable.
All it takes is one. All it takes is for you to have one experience or to know someone where that's happened, and that can certainly change the course of your estate planning.
It can change. And also keep in mind, too, that you can do a refinance. So to the extent that they did take this position and they weren't allowing you to undo it, then you can do a refinance. And while you wouldn't prefer that, and I get it, you're not happy about the fact that if you didn't improve your interest rate, you've spent some additional closing costs, et cetera. So whenever clients are doing this, they just need to be aware that this possibility exists, and are they going to handle it by way of just going forward and seeing what happens and being prepared to deal with it if it comes up? Maybe it's not an amount of money, a balance that would be a big problem for them. I've seen that approach. I've seen other approaches where this is what we often do, is we'll often approach the lender and try to get permission, and are successful maybe half the time.
Okay. So now that we've put our real estate into the trust, are there any challenges that we might encounter when making sure that maybe our children or our family that lives after us, that they maybe either get the house or can continue to live in the house in the event of our death?
Well, the nice thing about having a trust is that with a trust, you have continuity of title. So to the extent that the trust continues to own the asset, then once the asset's in the trust, then it's not changing at your death. The trust will still own it unless you have a provision that you thereafter want the trustees to distribute it to your loved ones, which they can do. They can take the title and transfer it into the individual names of your loved ones. But I often argue that the better deal is to keep it in the trust. It gives them asset protection. You can have what are called spendthrift provisions. It just means provisions in a trust that gives some really wonderful protection to people that you care about. It does not assume that your children are spendthrifts, though they may be. But that's a provision, actually, that applies to threats that can come out of nowhere. I mean, you can have a financial hardship. You could have an automobile accident and a lawsuit. Mm. I mean, we all know the risks of litigation. You could have a child that you want to qualify for some sort of federal aid due to a disability or an educational loan or long-term care. All those things, you know, would, if the trust is drafted correctly, this asset would not work against them in any of those scenarios. So in a way, it's the best of all worlds. So it's often a good idea to, once you put that house in the trust, mm-hmm. despite some of the concerns that we discussed about existing mortgages, once it's there, then it stays there, I would argue, even after you're gone.
Yeah, so if you don't owe anything on your house, there's not much of a risk, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if you've paid off your house.
Well, you mean to transfer it in?
Right.
Yeah, no problem whatsoever. And again, there may not be a problem to transfer it in if you do have a loan on the house.
Right.
It's just you need to think about it and make an intelligent call there. But I'm a big fan of letting your loved ones that you want to have the house, for example, you know, let them have it, have a right to live there. Let them be beneficiaries. Let them enjoy all the privileges and enjoyment of the property. But at the same time, have it protected from all those risks that lurk out there.
Mm-hmm. And there are plenty. All right. Well, some of those risks are external. Some of those are going to be a little bit more internal, and we create them ourselves by choosing executors who maybe have a conflict of interest. Or when we make that choice on who's going to be our executor, we need to make that wisely. And we need to look at probably all of those different aspects.
Yeah, the interpersonal dynamics. Mm-hmm. These are huge. And this applies, incidentally, whether you're talking about an executor or a trustee. I mean, they're very similar roles. The executor is called technically a person.
I was going to say, explain them to us, please.
Yeah, technically an executor is called a personal representative in the state of Missouri. Now, the personal representative plays a role similar to what a trustee does, except it's compressed in time. It's for a purpose of assuring that a proper will has been filed with the probate court, that those with valid claims get paid, and that thereafter what's left gets distributed to the right people. So that's kind of the responsibility of the personal representative. Well, a trustee has a similar responsibility. They're both fiduciaries. Now, a trustee, of course, his responsibility, his or hers, can go on for decades. It's not compressed into this assignment, this okay. project, as it is with the personal representative. But in both cases, it's not unusual to have more than one person appointed. And there are arguments for having more than one person appointed. You have the wisdom of several people. You have someone to watch over the shoulder of the other one. You may be able to placate factions that mm-hmm. might be concerned about a particular person. You have all these family dynamics that have to be considered. But unfortunately, sometimes people will perhaps placing hope upon hope that by their new wife, we'll call stepmom, by having stepmom serve with one of the children as co-trustees or co-executors, that somehow that will make them to work in a harmonious way because of the inclusion, when often all it does is sufficiently arm them so that now they can engage in deadly battle.
It just sounds like a recipe for disaster.
I know, all the while soaking up. I mean, this war is paid for by the estate. Mm-hmm. So all the while soaking up assets in a inter-family feud. So I think that you have to think about, on the one hand, do you want to have more than one executor? And it often is a good idea. Mm-hmm. I see the advantages. It can be a lot of work. You sometimes need people with different skill sets. This is especially true for trustees, but mm-hmm. you can see the similarity in both cases. So often it's great to have a division of labor in which you have one person who's strong here and another there. Sometimes it is a political decision where you want to appease certain factions within the family. And so it can be wise. But all too often, people, by virtue of a position, want to treat children equally. So without regard to their personalities, their capabilities, their responsibility, then they'll say, well, I can't tell you how many times I've heard this, I can't have mm-hmm. Joey, though he's the smartest and he's the most responsible, he's not the oldest. And it would really offend Susan, or it'd really offend Bill, his right. older brother.
Right.
So I've got to have Bill in charge of this. And it may turn out that Bill may be a raging alcoholic. He may have other temperament issues, whatever. So while I understand the motivation to show some equality among your children, to deal with them in an equal way as much as you can, I would say it's better to do that in the allocation of the assets than in the allocation of the authority in running either your trust or your estate.
Is it a good idea to have an odd number of people be in charge of your estate? I mean, I could see even with two people being deadlocked. Are you better off to have that third one, even if it's maybe not a sibling or a child?
It is often a good idea. That's a good rule of thumb, is to have odd numbers. And there's another device available to the extent that you're dealing with a trust, is you could have somebody who's what's called a trust protector. And this is a third party who kind of acts as a referee, or they can. And their role is to come in when there's a problem. So what's nice about that is you don't have three heads that need to reach a vote on every matter. Instead, you can conduct the business with a couple of people, and yet you have a third party who's available to step in to correct that. There's a similar position available with personal representatives, and it's not called a an estate protector, but it's a similar role. But especially as to trust, which really is a more sensitive matter in some ways because it endures for so long.
Mm-hmm.
And in this relationship between beneficiaries and trustees, there has to be some harmony there, at least a truce of some sort, so that there's not continual warfare. And in those cases, if you're going to have an odd number, it may be in the form of a trust protector rather than actual trustee.
So that person then is just kind of on call. They act as an arbiter.
Yeah.
For when the problem or when the situation arises that they just can't reach a conclusion on.
Yeah, a trust protector is a wonderful role, really, for this scenario and for a lot of other things, because it's somebody who can go about their lives, go about their business, but when something comes up, they can swoop in and solve it. That they're often given a lot of authority, including sometimes changing jurisdiction of a trust.
Hmm.
Tax laws can change dramatically. Imagine if you were planning your taxes in the state of New York,
mm-hmm.
and you didn't realize what was coming down the pike. And so at the time that you decided, well, this will be a New York trust.
Mm-hmm.
So it was the place of administration's in New York. So New York's be where naturally the authority would be. But now, fast forward decades, the tax rates have skyrocketed. There's all sorts of good reasons to not be there. And yet you're hostage. So one mechanism to solve that is to solve the problem that we can't see into the future and we don't know what problems will arise, is to create this powerful third party called a trust protector, and they have the authority to solve issues like that, to move to different jurisdictions as needed.
That sounds like a great idea, especially maybe right across the river in Illinois. Their tax laws are a little bit different than these in Missouri, so you might even look at something as simple as that just across the river.
Yeah, it's a marvelous tool and not often used, surprisingly.
Yeah. All right, this next mistake, it seems kind of strange to me that anybody would do this, but it has happened multiple times, and that's why it's made our list today. Surprising your spouse with the terms of your will. You better talk to your spouse when you're making a will, would be my thought, but it happens.
Well, and especially second spouses. You know, it probably doesn't happen quite as much with a couple that's been married for 30, 40 years, but I've seen it. And even where one of the parties has made arrangements for a child that was mm-hmm. born outside wedlock that the spouse didn't know about.
Wow.
But it's especially common, though, where you have a second marriage. It's an uncomfortable conversation, so it gets put off. More often when I've seen this happen, it's not because of a great intention to never have them know. It's more often that, well, I'll get around to that and I'll tell them. So the spouse may have felt some pressure from the children to do a particular thing, and that parent probably gave in, and the parent did not, though, tell their second wife or husband, and yet they may have intended to.
Mm-hmm.
But what the stage is set for there is an ugly fight.
Mm-hmm.
It's a similar point about not telling your children. In both cases, a fight that could have been avoided results where so much bad blood is spilt, as well as a ton of money.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can spend hundreds of thousands of dollars in these disputes, and it so often could have been headed off if the spouse and or the children were informed and granted this unpleasant meeting. I mean, that's the reason it didn't take place.
Right.
It was going to be unpleasant and stressful and whatnot. And maybe there wasn't a good way to explain what was being done. But I can tell you, even if there's not a good way to explain it, if it is explained and the kids get mad then, I can tell you there's far less likely to be a fight when they go. I mean, yeah, there may be a fight at that time, but it's not a legal fight.
Right.
It's a family argument. Maybe it spoils some Thanksgiving dinners, some Christmas dinner. I mean, and that's the worst case scenario, because it's simply not a basis for a legal dispute at that time. So by the time the parent dies, it's anticlimactic.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone knows. And there's not the allegation of undue influence. This is so often, I think, the real ignition for much of this dispute is the suspicion on the part of the wronged or the surprised mm-hmm. party that, you know, they took advantage, or he wouldn't really have done this, mm-hmm. or she wouldn't really, if she had had her right mind, she would not have done this to me.
Mm-hmm.
And yet the alternative is she has to say, yes, I'm doing this to you.
Mm-hmm.
And these are the reasons. These are the reasons I'm doing it. At least then the argument takes place between the parent and the kids, or the parent and the spouse,
mm-hmm.
and not in a two-year battle with lawyers and an estate, and the person who did it's gone.
Right. So have that awkward conversation.
Yeah.
Have
it's a cowardly way out to not do it.
Yeah. If they're going to get mad. I mean, they're going to get mad at you. They're going to get mad at the person later on. So you might as well just take the heat.
Yeah. Yeah.
So how often do you have situations where perhaps the person, it's a second marriage, but they've made their will earlier on and simply forget to change it? Do you run across that where they forget to add the new spouse or they forget to update their will?
Yeah, you do see that. Now, there are some saving statute. It's called like a pre-termitted child or pre-termitted spouse, where the law will rescue sometimes people who have failed to change a will. And there's a statute, let me reassure people who may have gotten divorced and they're saying, did I make that adjustment?
Did I do that? Yeah.
Well, I'm not suggesting that somebody rely on this because it may not produce the result they want, but there is a statute that says that as to a will, if you have a divorce, any provision that was made on behalf of the spouse or her family will be voided. It'll be as if they predeceased you. So what that means is whatever provision you have in your will for it's called a residuary clause.
Okay.
Whatever provision you have as that place where stuff goes that isn't otherwise named, that residuary would probably be where that asset would end up. So it may not be at all where you would want it to go if you had thought about it after your divorce and made a new plan. It may go to somebody entirely different, though it's somebody in your will. So it's not a good idea to rely on this provision, but at least I think the legislature was correct in assuming, look, this may not be what their ideal is, but it's definitely better than what was going to happen,
mm-hmm.
which it would go to the person that they like least in this world.
Exactly.
Probably.
Exactly. All right. So one of the other things that we've talked about a lot on this program is the role of the fiduciary. And so that's a really big, important thing and a big responsibility that we have. And so some people in their trust, they will name a corporation to be the fiduciary, mm-hmm. but then they may later on have them be able to be removed by an individual. So one person can remove the corporation. What do we need to look at in terms of that fiduciary responsibility, and who should we appoint for that?
Well, this is a topic that has been much debated among the states as they've all adopted, not all different forms from the Uniform Trust Code, but one of several variations, because states don't always agree about what is the degree of control that beneficiaries should have. So what would you say, I put to our listeners, what would you say if your beneficiaries had the power to jointly, if they unanimously agreed that they wanted to change the terms of the trust, and rather than have it paid out over the lifetimes perhaps of your children or to be protected until age 40, or you choose your example, instead they decided that they wanted to go ahead and have it all distributed now, or to change the distribution entirely from one of them to others of them.
Not sure I'm liking that idea.
And I think that most people don't who create trust. I think people who create trust, they want to be assured that those things they do will stick. So Missouri was relatively permissive in this way historically. And where it's ended up now, the law that's in effect now says that whatever changes that the beneficiaries unanimously agree to, it cannot be contrary to the underlying purposes of the trust. But my point is here that whenever you're choosing a fiduciary, that you want to select carefully, because this person can be the person that preserves your intention with the trust. And too often, trusts end up with not happening what the person intended to happen. So why bother? Why spend the money that you're going to spend for your trust? And you will spend more than you would otherwise spend, and not be confident that the things you care most about will happen. So fiduciaries are pivotal in making those decisions about how to assure that the trust ends up with the people that you want it to end up with.
Is it a good idea to really appoint a corporation, someone completely almost third party, or is it really a better idea to talk to an individual
who might
carry out your wishes?
I like the idea of corporate trustees. Now, they do want to see a significant amount of assets. By significant, I'll say there are some corporate trustees in Missouri who are happy with $1 million. Some will go down a little bit below that. But if there's not enough to warrant they're being compensated to manage, for example, say 1% of the estate, it could be 2%. I still think that's reasonable. I think it's very reasonable given that you have deep pockets, you have professionalism that you don't have with, you know, Uncle Bill. You have insurance. You have lawyers who are going to be sure that I's are dotted and T's are crossed. So you have a lot of professionalism. You have continuity. I mean, Uncle Bill could die in a car accident.
Right.
So you have continuity. So there's a lot to be said if you have enough money in your estate for having an institutional trustee. Now, some people say, well, I don't want only an institutional trustee. I want that personal touch. First, let me say that trust departments now and banks, I can tell you, have brought on people to give it personal touches. Mm. You'll be surprised the extent of personal attention that's available now through brokerage firms and others that handle trusts. I'm amazed. In Louisville, I've talked before about the fact that my aunt wasn't rich by many people's definitions, and she got so much attention and care in terms of personal things. Somebody from the brokerage firm went with her to pick out a car, and they would come by and check on her periodically. So it's amazing the level of attention that you can get whenever you have a trustee that's through an institutional trust. So on the other hand, I get it. Many people still want somebody that's more familiar, that's more intimate with them, and they think maybe the ideal combination is those two things, and I agree. And I don't, let's put it this way, I don't disagree. So for those cases, then, yeah, you could have two with a trust breaker under certain circumstances where there's a tie of a decision. But keep in mind that if there is conflict between the two, one could pull out. And if one pulls out, you need to have a provision to replace them with a similar person, either an individual or a corporate trustee. But to answer your question, I am a big fan of corporate trustees. And they're going to keep the beneficiaries in line, I think sometimes better than Uncle Bill. But I need to know your Uncle Bill. Some people out there may be saying, no, you know, the person I have in mind, they're the ones who will crack the whip.
They're not going to get away with anything, right?
Yeah, and I really want a more authoritative trustee rather than a more accommodationist trustee. Not all clients agree with me on this. Some clients want somebody more permissive. But I think that you can easily have the inmates running the asylum if you don't have a trustee that has some authority.
Well, speaking of the inmates in the asylum, the last thing that we probably have time to get to today is when we talk about children. So let's say it's a second marriage, you've got some stepchildren, you've got some biological children. What's the best way to make sure that you don't make any mistakes in dealing with stepchildren, biological children? Biological children typically have more rights as your biological children, but you may have a great relationship with your stepchildren. So what do we do?
Well, I do think that it is true that often people are confused about the law's distinction between stepchildren and biological children. Whenever you have stepchildren, then if you have a relationship where you want to treat them like children, then you need to specifically and specially say so, because the law will not do that. So if you make a reference in your will to my children, and I can tell you that that's going to be interpreted to mean children that were born of that marriage. It might mean children that were born outside the marriage. It's a little more complicated. If you've not acknowledged the child, then there could be a hearing. There could be some dispute over that. Simply for someone to simply step forward and say, I am his child, is not enough. There has to be some evidence of that. But I'll add this, too. Simply being a child born out of wedlock, unlike the law some time ago, they are not disqualified as being a child, but there needs to be more. There needs to be some acknowledgement of paternity, et cetera. But stepchildren, no. Adopted children, yes.
Okay.
If you have adopted a child, then that, and you say children, that term will be interpreted to include adopted children. So those who are close to their stepkids, you got to say so. You got to have terms in which you make that clear.
Well, we're about out of time.
Well, time went quickly, as it always does. We'll be back again next week to talk about these and other issues related to elder law. Till then, take care.
You've been listening to Elder Talk with Joe Cordell, providing smart solutions for seniors with attorney CPA Joe Cordell. Listen again next Saturday for another edition of Elder Talk with Joe Cordell, sponsored by Cordell Planning Partners, your elder law advisors. For more information, visit eldercarelaw.com. The choice of a lawyer is an important decision and should not be based solely on advertisements.